Republican Richard Murdoch is in what was considered a tight race for Indiana Senate seat. I'm Philip Bailey, and this is Noise and Notes. A recent poll has Murdoch down by 11 points to Democrat Joe Donnelly. Before that poll, Murdoch was in a tight race, focusing on small government policies and the attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya, while trying to keep his distance from controversial comments about rape pregnancies. I talked to Murdoch about his controversial remarks, working with the next president of the United States, and why he thinks the Benghazi attack is being overlooked.
I think clearly the Democratic Party is trying to sit on what happened in Benghazi. It's been since September 11th, and we still don't know what happened. We were told that it was all based on a video, and now in the last 48 hours, we found out within two hours, U.S. intelligence knew, in fact, it was Al-Qaeda-sponsored. Absolutely, the Foreign Relations Committee of the United States Senate should be investigating. They shouldn't be sitting on their hands.
What do you think a Senate investigation will do that the FBI and State Department and others are not doing?
Well, I think the United States Senate has not put enough pressure on this administration in the first place. I mean, we see a foreign policy that seems to be dictated by the idea that somehow America can lead from behind, and it cannot. I think having the Foreign Affairs Committee of the United States Senate start the investigation is going to send a message to our allies and our foes around the world that we're taking a more serious look at the way the United States is going to be supporting our friends.
You've called on your opponent, Democratic Congressman Joe Donnelly, to join you in that call for a full Senate probe. Do you think he will break his silence on the issue?
Well, look, this is a great time for Joe Donnelly to show some bipartisanship and join me as a Republican to call for his party that runs the U.S. Senate to have these hearings and have the investigation. You know, if Congressman Donnelly won't buck his party leadership before an election, he'll certainly never do it afterwards. This is a matter of the vital security interest of the United States. We've had four Americans, including the United States ambassador, assassinated. And still, we don't know what the story is because, obviously, the White House is sitting on a cover-up.
You say the White House is sitting on a cover-up, but in an interview on MSNBC's Morning Joe, President Obama said, quote, "I do take offense with some suggestion that in any way we haven't tried to make sure that the American people knew as the information was coming in what we believed," unquote. You're suggesting that there's a cover-up.
I am. It's either cover-up or incompetence. You know, 8 days after all of this happened, the President of the United States was on the TV show The View, I guess because he likes their hard-hitting questions, but he was on The View to make the point that this was all based on a movie. It was a spontaneous demonstration, and we now know within two hours, that U.S. intelligence knew what the source of this was. And if it isn't something that's being covered up, it's something that's certainly demonstrating incompetence, American public deserve to know which one it is.
It would seem that if there was a cover-up, that is an impeachable offense, is it not?
I'm not going to go there. I'm not sure what could be implied by that and what the laws would be, but certainly I think his failure is clear as commander-in-chief if, as we're hearing, there was a request for support and there was instruction given that they stand down. I'm not for a minute suggesting that it was the president himself who told them to stand down. But if we knew that our people were in danger and we had resources there that could have saved their lives, we should have been acting.
A National Journal story argues that the real story behind this is that there is no real story. No evidence that the White House misled the public intentionally, and the emails contain unverified intelligence information. Are you contending that the Senate needs to simply dig deeper or that there is some impropriety regarding information that requires prosecution?
I don't know if there needs to be prosecution. That's why you have the investigations. But I do believe that we need to know what the facts are, and there have been too many mixed messages coming out to make me feel comfortable that the White House has been fully transparent on the issue.
You've also raised the issue of the fact that the Democratic-controlled Senate has not passed a budget in 3.5 years. What's the chief problem with that, and why doing it in short-term resolutions, why is that a bad thing?
Well, the first thing, it's violating the 1974 Budget Act that was passed by the Senate of the United States and signed into law by the president. It is the law that every year the Senate is supposed to pass a budget. You know, no business can operate without a budget based on what the expected revenues are and what the expected expenditures are. And yet, what's clear here is the Senate leadership, Harry Reid, doesn't want the American people to really see that discussion, to understand where the spending is, and to consistently see that the Democrats want more spending and less fiscal accountability.
Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, has been heavily involved in your race. It is his majority PAC that's been running ads against you there. Is part of the reason why you're raising this issue and you're pointing this out is because of his involvement in your race?
Well, I would be pointing the issue out anytime there's a failure of leadership. As there's been a failure of leadership in the Benghazi situation, there's certainly a failure of leadership here with the United States Senate. It has been more than 3.5 years now since there was a budget passed, and it's required by law. And there's not a budget being brought up for discussion, being argued, or even voted on. This is a failure of leadership that explains in part why our deficits continue to grow and why our debt is absolutely exploding.
Do you find it difficult to talk about these issues, Benghazi, the budget, and focus on your campaign, given the controversy from your comments about rape pregnancies?
What I'm being asked about all the time is how we're going to get this country turned around again. You know, just this morning, we've made 4 stops already, and in each of those stops, the discussion is about the economy. It's about how are we going to see Obamacare repealed? How can we send a consistent set of messages from the federal government to American investors and small business owners so they know what the rules are, so they can begin investing again for the future, creating jobs, buying technology, moving America forward? That's what Hoosiers are talking about, and believe me, I love that discussion because I couldn't agree with them more. Those are the issues.
But it is difficult, isn't it? I mean, given the national attention, it is difficult to focus the campaign again, right?
No, as you just said, it's very easy to get on these issues because this is what the people are talking about. I think every candidate, be they Republican or Democrat, wants to be out there talking about the ideas that people are interested in. And overwhelmingly, this is the message I'm hearing, is how are we going to get jobs created? How are we going to get this economy on track? How are we going to lower our deficit? How are we going to stop craziness like taking the $716 billion out of Medicare that my opponent voted to remove from that program? I mean, these are issues to seniors, and these are the kind of issues Hoosiers are talking about a great deal right now.
Do you believe that controversy made you and your campaign stronger? Or looking back, do you regret those comments and that situation?
You know, you take one day at a time in every campaign, and if they could take campaigns and make them into roller coasters, I suppose there'd be amusement parks that would be operating those kinds of rides. But, you know, we're going forward, we understand what the issues are, and we've got solutions. You know, when I started my business career 38 years ago, never imagined that a 31-year resume in the private sector, 6 years in state government, would be such an asset in going forward to try to attack the fiscal problems our nation faces. And we're delighted to have that opportunity and to put that experience to work.
Looking ahead at different scenarios, if you win and President Obama is reelected, what are some areas you see yourself working with him on? Any place you see eye to eye with the president?
If he wants to present a jobs plan, if he wants to present some plans that will allow the free market to work, that will result in smaller government and cause us to live more within our means, then I'm all for that. I'll work with the man to do that. If, on the other hand, it's going to be let's have more government, raise taxes, or otherwise borrow more and more, I don't think that's the right direction for America, and certainly wouldn't be in his camp on those kind of arguments.
Best case scenario for you would be if Governor Mitt Romney is elected and the GOP gains control of the Senate and retains control of the House. How would the Republicans govern? Would your party govern from the center, or much like the Democrats governed during the first 2 years of Mr. Obama's presidency?
If the Republicans have the House, the Senate, and the White House, I think we're on the verge of an American renaissance. And that probably sounds to some listeners like an overstatement, but I really believe it, because our party, the Republican Party, recognizes that we have to send the message immediately to the investors of America that it's the right time to get back in the game, to start investing in American jobs and American energy, and to start setting the game so that people know what the rules of investing are. I think that would be the first priority in that scenario of having Republicans run all three of those offices or those three parts of government. If that happens, I think you're going to see a surge because investors will start putting money back in, jobs will be created, technologies will be employed, and that would be a very, very good thing for America. And I'd be proud to be part of that.
With 3 days until the election, Noise and Notes is giving voters another chance to meet the challengers in two area congressional races. Republican Brooks Wicker is challenging Democratic incumbent John Yarmuth in a race that many consider not worth watching. Wicker has struggled to raise money and gain attention, but he says there are plenty of issues to discuss: the fiscal cliff, lingering unemployment, and President Obama's record. Here is part of my interview with the GOP nominee about why he's running for Congress.
When I was growing up, I was always taught that by my parents that if you borrow something, you take it back better than you got it. And when you look at the big picture, we're not the owners of this country. Our kids are, our grandkids are. The future generations are the owner of this country. And I just didn't see that we were passing it along to them in better shape than we got it. That's what drove me to get involved.
Now, your trade, your business, you're a certified public accountant. So correct. Numbers are your forte.
Correct.
Let's get into numbers. One of the first items that Congress will have to deal with is after the election is sequestration. That represents about $1.2 trillion in automatic cuts to the federal budget. Should lawmakers allow that to take place?
I don't think so. I think they should have the guts to make the tough decisions and do the cuts where they need to be done. And the thing that is really troubling about this, sequestration is troubling enough, but we're facing, with that and with the tax increases that are coming January 1st, we're facing
some of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts.
Exactly. They're tax increases is what they are. They're not expiration tax cuts. It's an increase in taxes. With that increase in tax coming along with the sequestration, even the CBO says that's going to put our economy in a tailspin and more than likely put us into another recession.
Now, that's known to most as the fiscal cliff.
Correct.
Now, this will be something that obviously the lame duck Congress will have to deal with. But responsible and nonpartisan observers both say and both argue that instead of cuts to defense and domestic programs automatically, that we need to balance those cuts in spending with an increase in revenue. Now, as a Republican, are you open to any new revenue streams?
Well, I don't have a problem with increased revenue. It's how you derive the revenue. Let's just look at a little bit at history. Every time we've broadened the tax base, lowered rates, reformed the tax code so that everybody's paying on the same streams of income, everybody's enjoying the same deductions, and everybody's paying on the same rates, our economy has grown and revenues have increased every time. Every time we've just raised taxes, our economy has shrunk and revenues have decreased. So why would we want to just increase taxes when it has never worked? That has increased revenues and our economy has grown.
What are your thoughts on the Bush tax cuts? The issue seems to be that President Obama and the Democrats are arguing we should keep the tax cuts for the first $250,000 that everyone makes. I mean, everyone, whether you're a millionaire or someone who makes $251,000, that first $250,000 will continue at the same rates that they are now. But everything over $250,000 will go back to sort of the Clinton era, a time of prosperity. What's your objection to that?
Well, I think there's several things in that question. One is that 80% of the businesses in this country pay taxes as individuals. Small to medium-sized businesses create 75 to 80% of the jobs in this country, and they are the ones who are, by and large, taxed as individuals. Increasing the taxes on the companies, you're increasing taxes on individuals because they pay at the individual level, is not a good idea if you want to create jobs. You know, and I hear a lot where people say, well, Clinton raised taxes. It was a booming time. There was a little thing going on then called the Internet and the dot-com revolution. If you go back and look at time and you look at when Clinton's tax increases went into place, the economy slowed. Growth continued, but the economy slowed with those tax increases.
But did we see, the Bush-era tax cuts didn't create prosperity, did they?
Well, did they create prosperity? The Bush economy was growing and creating jobs up until, of course, we fell off the cliff in 2008.
So you're arguing that the Bush tax cuts did, in fact, help the economy?
I think that they did help the economy, yes, because we were in recession at the time that those tax cuts were in place. We came out of that recession and we experienced growth in the
economy. But what's wrong with the idea, or what's your argument against the idea of that those who are affluent, those who have prospered in this country, it's their patriotic duty to pay their fair share. Is that what you would consider to be socialism? Or?
Well, I'd reject the notion that someone should decide whose fair share is fair. What we need to look at is what happens in our economy. There are numerous studies that tell you there are tipping points in the economy. When tax rates hit a certain point, the economy shrinks. Why do you, we don't need to increase our taxes above those points. We are pretty close to those points now, if we increase above those points, our economy is going to shrink. We're going to have less revenue.
What about closing loopholes? That's been a seeming area of compromise between Republicans and Democrats, that instead of a tax increase or letting the Bush tax cuts expire, that we should close some of the loopholes that people have in other parts of the tax code.
That's what I was alluding to earlier when I said we need to reform the tax code so everybody pays on the same streams, everybody enjoys the same deductions, we get rid of the loopholes that are redundant and unnecessary. We need to streamline that so everybody is on the same page and understands what those deductions are, and everybody's paying on the same rates.
Now, your opponent, Congressman John Yarmuth, he's considered very liberal. I think you would consider him to be very liberal, yes. Whether you like that or not about him. But what's the biggest difference between you and the congressman? Are you a moderate conservative? Are you a staunch conservative? Are you a member of the Tea Party? What's the biggest difference between you and Yarmuth?
Well, pretty much everything, I would say. I mean, just pick an issue, and we're probably on opposite sides of it. The biggest difference is I'm a businessman with 30 years of experience working with small businesses, helping them, struggling business, survive, turn around, grow, create jobs. I've done that across multiple industries. And, you know, I bring 30 years of experience doing that. I'm a CPA, a financial advisor. I understand the markets. I understand tax systems. I understand regulations and how they affect businesses, how they affect growth, and how they affect the creation of jobs. I'm not sure that Mr. Yarmuth's background and experience quite matches that.
But
from where we are today, this is an economic race. This is all about economics. It's all about creating jobs. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently talking about all of the members of the House. This is both the House and the Senate. 80% of members had no financial or business experience. And we wonder why we're in the mess we're in.
80% includes Republicans, right? In a majority in a Republican-controlled House.
It does.
So you'd be in favor of throwing all the bums out.
Well, not all of them. There's 20% that have some experience.
Brooks Wicker, thank you for joining me.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
Democrat Shelley Yoder is running for Indiana's 9th Congressional District seat against Republican incumbent Todd Young. Though Yoder is a political novice who trails Young in fundraising, her campaign has come to life in the final week. She is running TV ads and has an endorsement from former President Bill Clinton. But Young is still considered the heavy favorite, and the National Democratic Party hasn't lent Yoder much support. We talked about President Obama's record and why she chose to run for Congress.
When I heard that Olympia Snow was getting out of politics at a congressional level, I was very disturbed and disappointed. She happens to be a Republican. I'm a Democrat. But I really enjoyed watching her govern and her style, very pragmatic, common sense style of governing. And so when she said she'd had enough, that she couldn't take the lack of collaboration any longer, she wouldn't go for reelection, I felt, who is going to step up? Are there other women in waiting to take her place? And this was happening at the same time that I decided to run. I'm doing it because I believe in fighting for the middle class. I think that hardworking families in the 9th District have gotten the short end of the stick, and I want to fight for them, and I still have a good amount of fight in me, and that's why I decided to run.
So as literally as this pillar of the Senate was wanting to leave, you saw that as a call to get in.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you about these issues, though, because I think that's a part of it where people really want to get into the meat of it. The theater is one thing, but the issues are another. When it comes to the national debt, the U.S. passed a recent milestone, and one that's not a good one, $16 trillion, that's trillion dollars, was passed. What should we do about that?
We definitely need to act, and one of the metaphors I like to use when talking about it is approaching our debt with more of a scalpel approach versus an axe just coming in there and slashing away at every program. There are areas where we need to look at our budget and find ways to save and begin approaching shaving those programs that no longer fully serve the American people, finding ways to close those loopholes, those corporate loopholes, finding ways to increase our revenue as well as decrease our spending. It's both sides of the checkbook. Families out across the 9th District are having to do the same thing. They're being creative. Our government needs to be creative in how we begin to approach or address this serious issue in our country.
Now, you said you don't want to face it with an axe. That's interesting because one of the first issues that's going to come up, the main issue after the election, is going to be these automatic cuts that Congress is going to face that go into effect in January. those will be applied to defense and domestic programs equally. Is that a responsible way to deal with government spending?
Sequestration is not a responsible way. I think we need to, as I said, look at this and find ways to apply scalpel-like measures to shave away those programs and departments that have areas that could be reduced, and making investments in areas that we know our return on investment will actually increase our revenue.
Now, should the Obama administration, there's been a lot of criticism of its government spending. What do you think about this administration? What grade would you give the president?
Well, I know when I travel throughout the district, there are many people who are frustrated because they're hurting. Families are hurting because they don't have the jobs that are paying the sustainable wages that are necessary in order to pay the bills, to give a chance for families to put their kids through college or even technical training. So that's what people are talking about. And looking at the performance of the president, I think that it's a mixed bag that's out there. People are on both sides of the fence there. But I would rather get to the business of solving our country's problems, looking forward and not looking back.
Because President Obama doesn't seem to be that popular in this region. How much of that blame is on the president's shoulders, and how much is on the fact that for at least half of his first term, there was a tense and ugly relationship with Congress? Most famously, Senator Mitch McConnell here from Kentucky said, you know, the chief goal out of 2010 was to make sure that President Obama was a one-term president. Who's to blame for the mess in Washington?
I think it goes against the American spirit and certainly democracy to be so consumed with pointing fingers and so consumed with that was my idea, not your idea, or that was your idea, not my idea, that we have stagnated the growth of America. We have to get back to what is good for the American people. And that's our goal, moving this country forward in the right direction, getting these good, sustainable jobs, turning this economy around, making sure that families feel, middle-class families feel, that the cards are not stacked against them, but for them, then we're going to see a much different atmosphere as far as when it comes to wanting change out of Washington, because that's really what people want. They're sick of the partisanship bickering. They want leaders, and they want people who are willing to reach across the aisle, work together to get this country moving again.
All right. Well, Shelley Yoder, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Philip.
Noise and Notes is produced at WFPL by me, Philip Bailey, with Brad Yost. For more information, visit WFPL.org.